What first alerted you to the idea that there was something wrong with the official narrative of the 9/11 story?
Well, in my case, I'm one of those people who just had a... I knew by noon on the day that it happened. I would look back on that and say I knew before noon on the day it happened that there was something very fishy. I'll skip the preliminaries about where I was and how my wife called me and such like that. But the thing is that I was in the living room with my family and tenants, and I was saying out loud to the TV, "Where's the U.S. Air Force? Come on, U.S. Air Force." I actually started to jump up and down on the living room carpet saying, "Come on, U.S. Air Force." I believed at that time that America was under attack, as the CNN logo had it. And I knew airliners were flying all over Hell's Half Acre. And I had a long-standing interest in aviation. I was in the Royal Canadian Air Cadets. I was a flight sergeant. I flew a Twin Beach. And I've always been interested in aviation. I say, "Where are the jet fighters? I know they scramble in minutes." I said, "This is impossible. Come on, you guys." And my wife said, "Calm down." And so after a while, I calmed down because I realized that something was really, really fishy. And that's when I said, "Wait, this can't be. This is impossible." And I said, "This is a Reichstag fire 2001. And it was the aviation that was my entree. At that time, I believed that the towers had pancaked because they were hit by planes and caught fire. But with the airplanes, that was it for me. And of course, my wife really thought that I was going mental. She said, "Barry, you can't really believe this." And I said, "What? No, I do. I'm sorry. I really do." She said, "You know, Americans would never kill their own people like that." And my wife gave me all the arguments we've heard since from everybody who can't believe it, who's in denial. And so in a way, I wouldn't say I started to research it. You know, I just couldn't help myself. I just was fascinated, and I just got all the information I could. I never would have dreamed that somebody's saying, "Well, I'm doing research." And then when my eyes got opened especially wide was in early January of 2002, when Michael Rupert came to Toronto to speak at the University of Toronto Medical Sciences Auditorium, and I'd encountered From the Wilderness already, and I thought, "My God, he's coming to Toronto?" And he gave two talks. I was there, and he connected the CIA and the money laundering and Wall Street and the whole nine yards. But by that time, I was already creating my own first commentary, and I actually gave him a copy of the draft when I met him personally. So I already got approval in December to do a series, which turned out to be seven commentaries, making me, I'm proud to say, the first journalist in the world to go on national television and seriously question the official story. And it's just gone on and on and on from there.
I was wondering what methods you use or what approach you normally take when you talk to people who are not familiar with the subject.
Well, I've been lucky in a way because I've been, early on, I was invited to, first of all, I did all my television work and I got a huge amount of positive feedback. See, and it surprised me. It did surprise me. And my producer at Vision TV at the time, when she came in to work the next morning after the first of my commentaries had aired, and that was the one where, in the very first one, I said that this, I didn't use the term inside job, I didn't know the term at the time, but I said this was done at the highest levels, right in the first one, but it was more or less in the form of a question. It was started off being asking questions. What really happened on 9/11? And then the producer I was working with, the line producer, he started talking about it being a great deception. I said, "You know, you really can't say that." He said, "Well, we can put it in the host links." And that caught on. Nobody complained. And then this email came in, the highest email that the channel had received in its whole 15-year history. Literally 99% positive. This was a real eye-opener. Nevertheless, the senior producer, when she came into work the next day after the first one aired, she said she was sick to her stomach. She was so sure that all this shit was going to hit the fan. And she opened her email, and the first one was positive. And she said, "Well, at least we got one positive one." Well, little did she know. So I right away, you see, I knew there was this huge constituency out there. This is January of 2002. So this affected my thinking a lot. People say, oh, you must be scared. And, you know, there's all these people are against it. I said, no, they're not. And as recently as today, I wrote a letter to the editor of the Globe and Mail in response to this half review they've done of my book, talking about that huge constituency, which now, according to the Scripps Howard Ohio University poll of August the 3rd, is that 36%, a nationwide properly done poll, 36% of the respondents believe that either the White House did it or allowed it to happen. That extrapolates to 70 million Americans. And in this review, they said that Zwicker and his allies, you know, have this crazy little idea. I said, I got 70 million allies there. I don't know if they're going to publish the letter. It's actually not too badly written. Also, I did a big search today on LexisNexis and everything and found out, of course, that the Globe and Mail had never covered, had never reported this Scripps Howard Ohio University poll results. They never carried them. And I want to be able to say that the Globe and Mail didn't, but I did a bigger search and it turned out that not a single Canadian daily newspaper covered the results of that survey. So I said, this is why I unapologetically call my book The Media Cover-Up of 9/11, because this is just the latest example. But the way I deal with it is just flat out combative, in your face. I state it all the time everywhere. And I don't care whether people agree with it or not, but what I find out is that most people are ready to listen. And so if it's really bad, you know, you encounter people who are hopeless. I encountered that, a big radio producer in the States today. She's just hopeless. You know, you don't really believe that, do you? There's a tone of voice. Well, it had to be Islamic terrorists. Are you saying it wasn't? And so I say, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's an inside job. If you want me as a guest on your program, okay. You know, when will you let me know? I don't think I react very well to people who believe the official story, and I don't meet that many of them. There is so much evidence. Besides these polls, that there's vast constituency of people who don't believe the official story. And the one I like, the most recent one, was I was in Toronto. I had to get a coffee. I went to Starbucks. Usually I don't like to go to Starbucks, but it was the closest one. So I went in there and I asked for a large cappuccino. And the young woman who was making it, I was wearing a T-shirt that had been made when I did a talk in Seattle with Webster Tarpley. You know, the truth about 9/11, there's a picture of Webster Tarpley and Barry Zwicker. She said, what's the T-shirt? Oh, so I sort of straighten up and I say, well, it's a 9/11 truth T-shirt. You know, and there's my picture. And so, and I didn't even wait. I said, because sometimes I wait. You know, they'll ask me a question and so on. I do it different ways. And so I said to her, do you believe the official story of 9/11? I was that blatant. It was a complete stranger. I said, do you believe the official story of 9/11? And there were people who could hear. And she said, no way. She said, I don't know anybody who believes the official story. She said, I know they're out there, but I haven't met one personally. I love it. But you know what? We don't have to be apologetic.
Can you tell us what are, for you, the most compelling facts which that convince you of that the official narrative is not true? The ones that really scream out. I know there's many, many of them.
Yeah, and you've got to talk about evidence, whatever the audience, or whenever you're having a conversation, because we have to go back to evidence. That's what you use in courtrooms. That's what really normal, rational people use in regard to any question in life. And the aforementioned airplanes still, to me, is the clincher. One of the reasons that it's valuable is circumstantial evidence. What it is, but circumstantial evidence is perfectly admissible in courts. You see, and everybody knows that no jet interceptors turned up until it was too late. It's just everybody knows it. So you have a common, like what they call a cognitive community on that. The next thing is World Trade Center Building Number 7. Now, the beautiful thing about that, with newbies, if you will, people who are not too familiar with this. I was in Calgary yesterday, a tremendously successful meeting in the Unitarian Church in Calgary. And I asked hands up, how many people knew that there was something called World Trade Center Building Number 7 that fell down that late that afternoon? And I believe, you know, I didn't count them, but I think it was under 10%. I thought, great. So I just showed 5 minutes from my DVD showing it falling and how that could only be done by controlled demolition. So that is a big one. Another one is a Bush being in that classroom in that elementary school, he's told by his chief of staff of the time, Andrew Card, a second tower has been hit. America is under attack. Really clear. Bush says that's what he said. Card says that's what he said. There's no argument about what he said. Okay, so the president is told that the country is under attack. He's also the commander in chief. And then he does nothing for at least 8 minutes, except read a story about a pet goat. And I think it was longer, but let's be conservative. It was a minimum of 8 minutes. So this is actually virtually impossible. I mean, even an ordinary person, not a president of a country, if they were told there's a tremendous emergency that you're responsible for, it's inconceivable that you would continue to, you know, paint your fingernails or whatever you were doing. So those are three anomalies that are really monstrous. And then, of course, when you get into more knowledge about it, as many people have, the degree of knowledge of this is surprisingly high. I keep running into people who know stuff, and they're telling me stuff. I'm learning stuff from people. And so they've been looking into it, and they found out this and that and the other. But the fact that, so the airplanes didn't show up. Now, we learn there were all these war games, these military exercises on the day, many of them. Michael Rupert said there were five, with these confusingly similar names like Northern Vigilance and Vigilant Guardian and Northern Guardian and so on. But now it turns out, if you follow Paul Thompson's cooperative research timeline, that there were, I don't know, 15, 20 of these exercises. They really did it up brown. I mean, they caused maximum confusion. I mean, none of those flyboys had a hope of doing their job. There's multiple confusions. First of all, they have the war games to begin with, and so people have orders to do things that are out of the ordinary. That's one thing. And instead of them just being on standby to scramble and so on, they're supposed to fly off to Canada and engage in a mock exercise with a real plane or an unreal plane or whatever. Now, right in Canada, you know, there was part of this was evident in Canada. Most people don't know that there was a Korean airliner coming over Anchorage and was due to land in Whitehorse. And the pilot allegedly sent out a signal saying he was being hijacked. So actually, a fighter escort was sent up, whether it was from Cold Lake, I don't know, and escorted this plane down, made a safe landing at Whitehorse. CBC producer in the morning show called me and asked me what I thought about this. That's the first I knew about it. The pilot got out. He said, I did not press that button, the I am being hijacked button. I think it's two or three numbers they punch in. He said, I didn't do it. So the CBC called air traffic control in Anchorage, and they said, we don't know anything about this. And so nobody knew anything. What it was they insert, this is the war games people, the high-ranking military, when they're doing these things, they insert fake electronic signals. So they made it look like that airliner was saying he was hijacked. It's all disruption. This is all nonsense. But it did keep some planes occupied in that area of North America. So the purpose is to confuse legitimate people. You see, you couldn't tell the whole U.S. Air Force, we're going to have a false flag operation. We want all you guys to join in. You know, if you hear that an airliner's gone off course, don't do anything because it's actually a trick. Can't do that. All these guys are going to do their job. So you got to find ways to obfuscate. You got to find ways to neutralize, paralyze, confuse them every which way. So you had planes that were called too late. You had planes that were sent to fly in circles over the Atlantic. You had planes were sent in exactly the wrong direction. You had planes like at Andrews Air Force Base, which is 12 miles from the Pentagon, two fully equipped scramble-ready squadrons that simply weren't activated until it was too late. They took off after the Pentagon was hit. So this is the kind of stuff we learn. This is just a minuscule portion of the evidence that 9/11 was designed. It was an inside job.
One of the things that I've heard recently, I heard David Barsamian, the host of Alternative Radio, he was interviewing somebody, I forget the person's name, he was a logician or a philosopher, and he was using sort of standard logical tools to debunk the, as he called them, 9/11 conspiracy arguments. And he was just sort of saying, you know, things like, or just because many, many American administrations in the past have done things like the Reichstag operation and like Operation Northwood, it doesn't mean that this one did, right? And also, Noam Chomsky as well, I was quite disappointed to hear him say that this administration is already guilty of war crimes. We don't need to look any farther. And he just kind of like shuts the debate down with that. What's your response to this kind of thinking?
Well, chapter 5 of my book is 15,000 words, and it's titled The Shame of Noam Chomsky and the Gatekeepers of the Left. I was a huge fan of Chomsky for years. In the early 70s, I have 16 of his books. I interviewed him 3 times for TV. I used to praise him in my university classes. A friend of mine and I used to have a competition which one could get more letters to the editor published defending Noam Chomsky against people who were unfairly attacking him. Really, I was pro-Chomsky. I helped in a small way to make the movie Manufacturing Consent. Okay, that's how deep I was. But there was always something I wondered. I always wondered, how come Noam Chomsky maintained, to begin with, and has maintained to this day, that John F. Kennedy was killed by the lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald? He absolutely said that. As recently as 1993, he wrote a book called Rethinking Camelot, which was a real hit job on the Kennedys, and said it didn't matter that President Kennedy was killed anyway. They're all the same, so no individual president can make any difference. Robert Kennedy was killed, it was the same thing with Chomsky. He said, yeah, Sirhan, Sirhan. He bought the official story. Martin Luther King Jr., same story. James Earl Ray, sure, single gunman. Malcolm X. And the thing is that all sorts of people on the left, including myself, think that Noam Chomsky is saying these terrific things. We got to wake up about East Timor. Look at the death squads in Latin America. All this terrific criticism of the depredations of the American empire. But it's curious that he's got this stand on JFK. Just take JFK alone. So, and I had friends say, it's curious, you know, we're mystified. We're really puzzled. This is really strange. We can't figure this out. And I was one of those. I said, you know, I just couldn't figure it out. I really couldn't. And what I did was, when I couldn't figure it out, I put it aside. I cut him slack. You know what? I realize now I was in denial. Here's what I say in my book. And here's what I came reluctantly to believe, because I did the research. That Noam Chomsky, from his track record, is an agent of disinformation. Okay, now I'm not saying he's a disinformation agent in the sense that he's on the payroll of the CIA, can't prove that. Okay, but he might as well be. I forget whether I use those words in the book. And so he constantly says, you phrased it well, he constantly says, and so does David Barsamian, his chief acolyte and promoter, they always say, oh yeah, well look, we've got them nailed for treason for these huge crimes. They shouldn't have gone into Iraq, blah, blah, blah. Well, the thing is that trying to get a giant empire because it's generally criminal is like trying to pin jelly against a wall. With 9/11, which I insist myself, I believe and preach this, that 9/11 is the supreme litmus test for every individual, every organization, every discipline. Okay, where do you stand on 9/11? The evidence now is abundant that it was an inside job, that it was a false flag operation, that it was Reichstag fire 2001, which is horrible, is criminal, is treasonous, and it's the Achilles heel of that whole neocon gang. Because if that can become known by a sufficient number of people that it's politically relevant, they could end up in court, in jail. Okay, and that, what do you do when you face a huge opponent that has humongous resources? You look for the weakest link. You look for the Achilles heel. That's what 9/11 is. That's why it's the key, pivotal thing. It's obviously changed history. Everybody agrees to that. But it's the linchpin for the so-called war on terror and all the horrible stuff that is based on the war on terror that's justified by the so-called war on terror. Now, of all the people who should get that, Noam Chomsky is numero uno in the world, right? He is tremendously informed. He's tremendously intelligent. He digs out all sorts of information from obscure places. He mentions these obscure journals where he gets information. He's known as Mr. Evidence, practically. Okay. Also, he's fearless, because I've heard so many people who are in denial, like I used to be in denial about Noam Chomsky, saying, well, you know, he could be mistaken. He could be afraid. Maybe he just doesn't know the facts. All these things. None of them can apply to Noam Chomsky. I'm sorry. Because you just go down through those and none of them apply. So there has to be another explanation. And I think it's very dark. I think he is, as I say, an agent of disinformation. It's called a bait and switch redirect operation, what you do is you say stuff that people will admire and buy and value tremendously. And I wouldn't take any of that away from him. All that stuff he's done, the huge body of his work, that has earned him tremendous influence on the left. So how has he used that influence? When it comes to these toxic events, these assassinations and so on, an ongoing coup by the neocons, what does he do with those? Constantly redirects people away from them. Now it's become worse. Now he is trashing people who just say the questions should be asked. And I've got some brand new audio tape. It's just 48. It was done on the 24th. I recorded off KGNU Denver, where Barsamian flew to Boston to interview Chomsky. And there's 25 minutes. It's titled Global Warming, Peak Oil, and Conspiracy Theories. You spend the last 15 minutes on conspiracy theories. Barsamian says to him, he says, well, there's these conspiracy theories. You know, what do you think about them? And Chomsky, with this trademark laconic, dismissive. You got to, this guy, I've identified 20 sly propaganda techniques that Chomsky uses all the time. And one of them is sardonic dismissiveness. Well, it doesn't matter who killed Kennedy. He's actually said about 9/11, it doesn't matter who did it. He has said that. Okay, I've got the transcript. Not only that, he said it lots of times. So in this interview, he says, well, I'm not too interested in all this. You know, these people, it's an industry. Okay, it's an industry. This is tremendous put down, right? Number one, the idea is that people like 9/11 truth people like me are doing it for the money. Okay, first of all, since when is it a bad thing to make money in this society? Okay, the second thing, the reason it's wrong, is we're not making money on it. Okay, everybody I know is losing money. Okay, we're doing this for other, so it actually imputes a negative, it imputes a nasty motivation to us that we don't have, okay, and which is not true to boot. Okay, also he's a hypocrite. He's a very rich man himself, right? And then to call it an industry suggests that we are a tiny band of enthusiastically mistaken cultists. Okay, that's essentially what he's saying. It's a 4-point put down. That Noam Chomsky, the master of propaganda, is aiming at us. Okay? So then he says, you won't believe this. I'm going to be using this tonight if we can get a CD player. He says, well, most of them are religious fanatics or religious fundamentalists. I mean, he's desperate. This redirect agent is desperate because, I mean, I don't know any religious fanatics in our movement. Maybe there are some. I just haven't met them. Then he says very many disparaging things. He also says some very bizarre things. And that's, what, by the way, one of his propaganda techniques is saying bizarre things. And no one calls him on them. Well, just bizarre things. Here's the latest bizarre thing. Latest example, 48 hours old. He says, this question, who benefits? It's worthless. He actually says that. I've got it on tape. I've got it on the CD. Who benefits and follow the money are two of the most powerful, you know, principles and guidelines you can follow to find out what's really happening. Who benefits? That goes back to Latin days. And he says it's worthless. His very word. Okay. He says a lot of stuff. Okay. Get this. At the end of disparaging the 9/11 truth movement tremendously, he says they're wasting their time. They're drawing a lot of energy away from valuable things they can be doing. He said that over and over again. That's in my book. This new stuff is more incendiary than what I included in my book. If people think I'm too hard on them in the book, wait until they get a wind of this, the latest things he's saying. Because at the end, he says, it wouldn't surprise me if 30 years from now, we found out that the 9/11 truth movement was being run by Bush. Now, that is both bizarre and a really horrible put down. And it's almost hard to figure out. In other words, he is saying the 9/11 truth movement is like a covert black op that Bush is running in order to make the Bush regime look good somehow. And it would figure if the majority of the public did think that the 9/11 truth movement is a bunch of wackos. The least anybody could do if there's any kind of a controversy, any scintilla of doubt on any subject, is say it could do no harm to investigate it further. You know, they wouldn't even have to say Barsamian and Chomsky. They wouldn't even have to say we want a full-fledged reopening of it. No. But they could say, well, there's enough people who doubt, and there are some lingering questions apparently in some people's minds. We ourselves take Osama bin Laden at his word. That by I got Barsamian on tape saying that. He says, why don't we just believe Osama bin Laden? He says he did it. Isn't that good enough?
Just talking about the 9/11 truth movement, I was wondering how much unity there is within the 9/11 truth movement. Do you find that there's a lot of people disagreeing with one another or different takes on what the evidence means?
Sure. Oh, there's... Now, I think you used the word disunity. Unity or disunity, how much agreement, disagreement, and so forth. There's no question, of course, that in the 9/11 truth movement, there are differences of opinion. Not only that, but some people have become quite excited, and some of them get to engage in name-calling and so forth. However, my take on it, for what it's worth, is that essentially there's unity in the 9/11 truth movement. That is, the majority of people associated with it, and not necessarily some of the people toward the center of it, agree on the general outlines of what happened, that it was an inside job. At the very least, if they possibly can be said to belong to the 9/11 truth movement, they say, well, the Bushites let it happen. Now, this is very tricky, you see, because there are really four ways to look at 9/11. One, you believe the official story. Second, you say, well, it happened because of incompetence. Third, it happened because they let it happen. Now, all those three have one thing in common. They all posit that there were 19 crazed Arabs who did it. Okay, the fourth one is the inside job, or the made it happen on purpose. But it's a curious thing about boxes 3 and 4. Because as lawyer Phil Berg says, they either made it happen or they let it happen. And if they let it happen, they made it happen. Okay, you either got executive, it's done in an executive way, or you got complicity. But in any event, that is not a big point of dissension in the movement. And almost everybody's in box 4 now in the movement. So the arguments have to do, well, did an airliner hit the Pentagon or was it missile? And some people make a very, very big issue of that. And in my book, I avoid that controversy, not that I don't have an opinion on it, by saying, look, it's a secondary question. And you can understand a lot of the unity, disunity arguments and everything in the 9/11, in the area of 9/11, by recognizing there are primary questions, secondary questions, and tertiary questions. Okay. Did an airliner or did a missile or did a Global Hawk with a missile or Global Hawk alone or a drone hit the Pentagon? Okay. That is a secondary question. The primary question is, how could any aerial vehicle, an airliner, a missile, a Global Hawk, a blimp, or a Cessna have penetrated the most protected airspace on the planet successfully to hit the Pentagon? The answer to that question is it couldn't happen unless it was designed to happen, unless it was allowed to happen, unless it was made to happen. So what hit? I have my ideas on that, but I'm not willing to get into an argument about it. Now, some people who get into big arguments in the 9/11 truth movement, I don't think are authentic. You know, 5 out of 6 tyrants agree. Divide and conquer works. So that you have agents within the movement. And they are there to spy. They are there to cause dissension. They are there to sabotage things. They are, you know, they're sheep dipped or whatever, so that they'll be people who turn out to look stupid, and then that will tarnish the movement, etc. All the usual tricks of the so-called intelligence agencies. But I addressed that at the Chicago 9/11 Truth Conference in early June, and it was a full house. I mean, people couldn't get in. They were standing and everything. A lot of interest in this. And we navigated this area without any name-calling or dissension whatsoever, because people are ready to look at this and realize, of course, they've infiltrated our movement. They infiltrated labor unions, the peace movement, the Communist Party, COINTELPRO, of course, of course, of course. There's no question, Black Panthers, no question. The only question is, who are the agents? You cannot tell the agents by looking at them. Like, you people are really nice and friendly and everything. You could be agents. No, seriously, you could, because they don't hire people who look stupid and drool. they hire really slick people, and they hire young people too, and they keep them in a long time. That you got to study the intelligence agencies, you know, really as a part of your education if you're going to be in a social justice or movement or anything like that, any kind, anything that's political, and because you can't be naive about that. But I think that most of the people in the movement that I know, there's tremendous unity, to use your word, at the Chicago conference and the LA conference, the beginning and end of June. If you had been there, the groundswell of excitement and unanimity and energy and positive vibes of all kinds, it was just there in spades. These were exciting meetings. It's like if you are... I don't know, if you're a horse breeder or something, you go to an international horse breeding meeting, you meet all the other horse breeders, the finest horses, or that, you know, a wonderful, wonderful feeling. Well, that's the feeling at these big meetings. So I don't think that I think that the people who want to sow discord are losing. I think they're just being surrounded and bypassed, and they're being spotted too. They're really easy to spot when they start calling names. See, first of all, what I said at that meeting is people should not call names, should not label each other and call names. And you just shouldn't do that, because it's not a rational or fair way of debating. We should be debating ideas. You know, you don't call people jerks, you don't call them like things like that. So anybody who does is either deliberately trying to sow discord, or they're undereducated about how to discuss things in a civil way. So what you do is you say, we're not going to do any name calling around here. So anybody who does it stands out. And there are lots of other ways, you know. But meanwhile, you got the moles. They're really clever and they're there anyway. So you can't do anything about that. But I think the movement is growing humongously.
How many people were in Chicago?
Chicago was, I think, 900 or so, and LA was 1,200.
900, like in the audience?
Yeah.
Wow.
Delegates.
900 delegates?
Well, call them delegates. 900 people attended, registered. Right. Yeah, yeah.
I have one more question, and Julie, you want to ask about the other terrorism, right? My question is, as the first journalist on national television to talk against the official narrative, how did you feel? Like, that must have been a bit of a daunting task before you to... nobody had done this before. At that point, these ideas were in the realm of the conspiracy theory. So how did you sort of get up there and do that?
Well, it wasn't hard at all. I mean, it was not hard to do. I was totally motivated. And I will say, there's something... I think the main regret I have about my book... And it's not a large one. There may be other regrets I have when people discover huge errors in it I still don't know about. But right now, the main regret I have is that I did not give credit to Rita Devereaux, who was the executive producer at Vision TV, executive producer of in-house production at Vision TV then, because she and also the senior producer, Sadia Zaman, they did not block me. And Rita, as the executive producer, really... let it happen. You know, if you let it happen, you make it happen. Mm-hmm. And she was very good. She was my mentor, and she was a tremendous director. And but I had earned my spurs at Vision TV. I'd been there 15 years. And Rita, you know, said at one of the retreats, she said, Barry is a real producer. He always produces. He never fails. He always comes through. And, you know, it wasn't true of everybody, you know. So I have work ethic, I would feel terrible if I ever let anybody down when I'm writing an article, producing a TV show, or writing a book or whatever. And so I got the idea, and then I was, however, now here's a hard part, if you will. It didn't feel hard, but it was an obstacle. I got the idea that, first of all, I was extremely naive. I guess this would be the last question. Okay. I'll try to bring this down a bit, though, but it's relevant what you ask. I was extremely naive to begin with, because when 9/11 happened, I knew it was an inside job. So I was thinking, loads of people have to see it's an inside job. there's these absurdities and contradictions and impossibilities right in front of your eyes. So there must be people at NBC, CBS, the CBC, Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times, all over the place. They've seen this and they've decided that they have to keep quiet about the investigations they're launching because there's all this patriotic, you know, fanaticism about these horrible Arabs did it and we've got to sing the Star Spangled Banner and stand up for the country and bomb Afghanistan. But I thought, meanwhile, in the newspapers and the TV networks, there are people, teams of people out there digging out the stuff. And I was waiting. I actually was waiting to see this stuff. And I thought, this is going to be really something when the Washington Post comes out, like it did with Watergate, and say, you know, I don't know what they'd say, but they'd say serious questions, you know, about where was the U.S. Air Force. It didn't happen and didn't happen and didn't happen. This is in my book. And finally, in November, I went to the chief investigative reporter at the Globe and Mail, where I used to work for 8.5 years. I knew him well, and I said, I'd like to meet you. I think there's a big story. He said, sure, meet me in 2 hours, go up. Met with him for an hour and 20 minutes. I said, now, you may think I'm crazy, but I think that 9/11 was really fishy. And he's looking at me. He said, yeah, no, that's fine. And he's making some notes. I look back on it, made curiously few notes, I realize, in retrospect. But and he actually said a couple of things that indicated that he suspected that there was something fishy about it. He talked about the muscle men, that's, you know, the hijackers and so on. And that was Victor Malarek. And so I said, thanks a lot. And I left him a very carefully selected small packet of information. I remember there was Jeff, what's his name? I named him earlier in the interview.
Stan Goff.
Thank you. My chips are going down. And yours are still up. And I gave him some stuff probably by Baikov and probably something by Rupert. And he made about 12 pages altogether, just key anomalies. And I said, could I send you some other stuff? He said, sure. So subsequently, I didn't hear from him, but I sent him another envelope by surface mail, some other really good stuff, gold. Didn't hear from him. I sent him a total of then two more packets by surface mail. Have not heard from him to this day. Okay, the Globe and Mail never did anything about it. Okay, so then by November, I thought, holy mackerel, they're not going to do anything. And then you won't believe this, but I actually thought, hey, I've got my own television program. I could do something. But whoever dreamed that somebody who is a half-hour program, who does all his own research, all his own writing, all the paper editing, all the video, would do this. But I thought, well, you know, it's the thing, it's really step up to the plate because nobody else is doing it. But then I thought, wait, it's going to be tough to introduce this to the producer team because there's 15 producers. So I thought, well, I've got to really prepare carefully before I bring it to the producer team because I knew there were different ideas about it. And I thought, oh, I'm prepare. I'll have to get it on the agenda. You know, should I be the first one to speak or the last one to speak? And, you know, should I read from it? Should I hand them out something? I'm thinking of all the ways that I can politically introduce the idea of my doing what I thought should be six commentaries. I'd broken it down into six pieces, you know, the airplanes and da-da-da. And without it getting shot down, because I thought that would be so disappointing. I mean, I've got to be successful at getting the approval. And I couldn't really find a way to do it, you know, because I was stalled out because I wanted it to be perfect and I was scared that it would be turned down and everything. And finally, in November, late November, we had our producers meeting. And so somebody says, well, who's got new ideas here? And I said, I do. I've got an idea. I feel really, really strongly about this. Some of you people know. And I said, believe it or not, I honestly think, and I think there's a lot of evidence, that 9/11, I didn't know the term inside job then. I said that 9/11 was done by the U.S. government. And you know what? Nobody said that's crazy. They said there's a little discussion, and one producer, I remember, said, well, you know why? I was going into the substance. The U.S. Air Force didn't take off. And I remember this one producer said, well, you know, you can explain all that. They just hadn't had their coffee that morning. You know, this is the level. And so it ended up, and I said, I think it should be six. So people are going along with it. And the senior producer said, no, I think six is too many. And I said, well, what are you saying? And she said three segments. Okay. Oh. And then she added, let's do three and see how it goes. And it was six. It was six. And then there was a previous one I'd done, actually, which tied in beautifully to it, so that when the video came out, it was seven. I mean, we just tacked that one on the front. So it turns out in the video it's seven, but it was six on air. And well, it's on the Canadian Basic cable, and whatever percentage of the audience it has, 3% or something. But it's 8 million. It's more than 8 million households. I don't think so. No, what you'll find, Vision is a separate network on the cable dial.
Yeah,
and
we have Vision here.
Yeah. And it's, I don't think that it has anything to do with the Knowledge Network. No, they have the Body, Mind, and Spirit channel they added, and now they've got a Christian channel. So that Vision TV is now running three channels.
Oh, wow.
But the Knowledge Network is totally separate. In fact, I think it's a BC thing, isn't it?
Knowledge is BC.
Yeah.
But I'm getting confused, I guess.
Well, people confuse channels. I confuse channels.
Something that Vision did on Knowledge.
Program sharing.
One thing I was wondering about is what's been happening in the media lately with a lot of these new terrorist attacks or nearly thwarted terrorist attacks and things like that. Are you seeing any similarities with 9/11? What's your take on these things, like namely the terror cell, the alleged terror cell that was brought down in Toronto, and the recent 10-plane hijacking, and the not-so-recent London underground bombing, all these kinds of things. Have you looked into those?
I've looked into some of them. Like London 7-7, there's a long stretch of 15 pages or something in the book about London 7-7. We go into pretty deep background about that. We call it Her Majesty's Terrorist Network. It was false flag operation. There's all sorts of evidence of that. And this latest one you mentioned, I call it the transatlantic exploding shampoo terror fraud. And a lot of people don't believe it. You know that I when I was getting on the plane in Toronto to come out west, and as I was entering the cabin of the plane, there was a co-pilot and about three flight attendants standing there. How they do, you know, when you enter a plane. And they were in a jovial mood. They're laughing and smiling and everything. And I like to just reach out suddenly to people. I just do it without even thinking. And so I planted a smile on my face so they wouldn't think I was serious. And I said, hey, you guys, how can you be so happy when there's all this terrorist stuff going on? And the flight attendant right in front of me said, it's all a fraud. And all the others chimed. They said, yeah, it's all fake, fake, fake. They know it. Come on. So many people know it. The public talks I've given, I've told that anecdote because it was an anecdote that launched my tour. And large numbers of people in the audience say they don't believe it. They don't believe it. And, you know, when I didn't need any further. I mean, nowadays I can just see a headline. And sure, I can be wrong. I don't want to get too doggone smart ass here. But the thing is, there's such a thing as intuition. You know, like Malcolm Gladwell in his book, Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. You know, you see something that looks like a duck, it's a duck. And when you see these headlines and it's just police sources, anonymous police sources, and it's so perfect, and it just serves the ends of the people who would want that kind of stuff to happen. I mean, do you really? I mean, somebody should investigate it, but I don't have time. I just identify it. And I say to audiences, and actually I get applause for saying this, I say, I believe the time has come when we see, read, hear that there is an alleged terrorist outrage has happened, that we should automatically assume that it is a fake until the evidence comes in otherwise. And I get applause for that. People are at the stage, they see that. And if you needed any added information with the transatlantic exploding shampoo terror fraud, they always try to spin it out, you know, to give it legs. I'm talking about the psychological warriors who do this, spin these sordid tales. When I read that there was an Islamic couple that were going to use their infant baby as a bomb, that is so sick. That is right out of the bowels of the diseased CIA psychological warfare department. And also, when you hear about babies being used, you know, in the First World War, the British said that the Germans were bayoneting babies. You know, they're sticking them with bayonets and throwing them in the air.
Yeah.
And actually, the Germans, the Huns, you know, lots of horrible stuff happens in war. And the Germans are a hell of a bad enemy. Somebody said that.
Yeah.
But they were not bayoneting babies.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, they weren't, yeah. And then
the babies being pulled out of incubators.
Precisely. Thank you. Exactly that. So when you hear about babies, beware. Check that story out, Six Ways from Sunday. And so, sure, these things are frauds, but the beautiful thing is, maybe the beautiful isn't the word, that people are catching on. People are catching on. I mean, I'm seeing it with my own eyes. Except the media are buying it almost hook, line, and shampoo bottle. I mean, gee whiz. And there are honorable exceptions. The paper called Sunday, the Sunday Star's Sunday paper, right after the exploding shampoo terror fraud, David Olive had a full page, and he'd been looking at the internet, and he was watching the chat rooms, and he was counting up all, and he was assessing all the different comments were coming into the BBC online chat room, NBC, CNN, and he found huge numbers of people weren't buying it. And so, you know, the cat's out of the bag. Now,
are journalists behind the scene, before the editors get to them, before, you know, David Black and all these people, are they buying it?
No, but I'll tell you, journalists are a very, very, very sad, pathetic lot. I've been doing media criticism for 36 years, and for some reason, journalists think that they're immune from being stupid, that they're immune from being part of you know, ongoing fictions and everything. And actually, they're more intransigent in their denial than your average person. Your average person, you can talk to about this. But when you try to talk to journalists, the higher up, the worse it is. They just don't get it. They don't want to get it. And they have so much vested interest now in not getting it. How much egg is going to be on the face of the media if they have to admit that they were asleep at the switch for 5 years?
Yeah.
So that's my answer.